Karen Armstrong is a one-woman publishing industry, the author of more than 20 books on religion. When her breakthrough book, A History of God, appeared in 1993, she gained a reputation as one of the world's leading historians of religion. Armstrong has a remarkably wide-ranging knowledge of spiritual traditions, from the monotheistic religions to Buddhism. She has little patience for literal readings of the Bible or the Quran, though she says sacred texts offer profound insights if we know how to read them. Steve Paulson talked with Karen Armstrong about her latest book, The Case for God.
You start your book by saying we're talking far too much about God these days, and what we say is usually very simplistic. So let me ask you, would we be better off if we simply abolished the word God, if we could?
No, there's no point in abolishing the word God in itself. The point is to listen hard to the inadequacy of our language. Any name we gave to God would be a problem, because what we call God lies beyond the reach of speech and reason. And in the past, theologians understood this very well, and people of the stature of Maimonides in the Jewish tradition, Avicenna in the Muslim tradition, and Thomas Aquinas in the Christian tradition made it clear that what we call God is only a symbol for a much greater transcendence. Some theologians have called the God beyond God, something that lies beyond anything we can think or know.
So you're saying that we are confusing the symbol with the underlying reality, which we can only get glimpses of.
Yes, this happened at the time of the scientific revolution during the 17th century, when scientists of the stature of Newton and Descartes claimed that they'd found a definitive scientific proof for God's existence. Newton thought that the intricacy of the solar system that he had uncovered pointed to the need for what we'd now call an intelligent designer who was omniscient, omnipotent, and, as Newton said, and I quote, very well versed in mechanics and geometry. And so God became a fact, a scientific fact, a scientific hypothesis, a scientific explanation. And that would have caused, you know, earlier theologians great consternation, because they always claimed that really you couldn't prove that God existed, because our minds can only deal with material beings and limited beings, not with infinity itself.
Well, this is a great irony that you're describing, because Newton and Descartes and other founders of the scientific revolution were in fact very religious, and they were trying to use science to prove the existence of God, but you're saying it totally backfired in the long run.
Well, in the long run, it did backfire. Science and religion were not at loggerheads, as people often assume. They were absolutely in love with one another and best friends, you know, right up into the 19th century. And Newton's physics and Descartes' physics, too, just wouldn't work without God. They thought it was essential to have some sentient, intelligent being to start the whole system going. But it was only a few generations until scientists like Laplace, for example, were able to find a natural explanation for the universe. And later, of course, still, Darwin would find a natural explanation for life itself. And that wouldn't have mattered a jot had not the theologians and the churchmen fallen in love and become intoxicated with Newton's proof. Science had in this period achieved such spectacular results that myth became discredited, and people thought that science was the only way, the most reliable way to reach God. And they lost the older habits of thought, which had been very reticent about saying what God was.
You're saying then that this idea of the designer God is really a product of the Enlightenment and
yes,
of these fathers of the scientific revolution, that idea really did not exist back in the founding of, let's say, Judaism and Christianity?
Well, the whole idea of creation out of nothing is not even in the Bible. It was certainly not an idea that was known in the ancient world. And when the Christians did decide that God had created the earth out of nothing, a very revolutionary new idea, they said that the corollary of that was that the natural world could tell us nothing at all about God, because our natural world and everything material in it had come from nothing, from an abysmal nothingness, and it could therefore bear no relation to the God that was being itself.
Now, the other piece of this modern discussion of God is the understanding that God has a personality, and we talk about a personal God, people having a relationship with God, and that God is wise and good and intelligent. Are you saying all of that is also a modern creation?
No, of course not, because the Bible presents God very much as a distinct personality in the very early days of the tradition. But it is a symbol of God. God must include personality because God is everything that is. As the Hindus say, God is the all. Everything that we can conceive or think of, that is God. And so that God must include personality, but must also go beyond it. And doctrines like Trinity, for example, were meant to remind Christians that you could not think about God as though God were a simple personality. Now, the idea of God as personality has all kinds of wonderful sort of sidekicks, if you like, because it helps us to value the human personality as sacred too. It helps us to understand the holiness of each human personality. And a lot of people do experience God as a personality, and that's absolutely fine. Nobody has the last word on God. Nobody can, because God lies beyond definition. And God comes to people in very many different ways. In the West, we do conceive of God more as personal, though less in the Muslim tradition than in the biblical traditions of Christianity and Judaism. But in the East, in Buddhism or Hinduism, the ultimate is not seen as personal at all. It lies beyond the personal, and yet it is within us all. And that's a very important development. All the world faiths insist that God is not something out there. Nirvana is not something far from us, a distant reality. God is also the essence of each being.
I want to take you back to what you were saying earlier about this effort to domesticate what you called God's otherness. And I think it goes back to this idea of sort of the natural human desire to name God, but actually, wasn't that resisted by a lot of the early theologians? That they were very explicit, saying that really God had no name and God had no definition.
Well, certainly. I think a model of authentic religious discourse was invented in India in about the 10th century before Christ. And it was called the Brahmojja competition. And the priests would begin by going into retreat in the jungle, in the Indian jungle, and there they'd fast and do preliminary yoga exercises to put themselves into a different frame of mind. And then they would return and the competition would begin. And its object was to find a verbal formula, a definition, if you like, of the Brahman, the ultimate reality in the Hindu world. And the challenger would kick off and he would give a very elliptical and poetical description of the Brahman. And the others would listen and they'd have to respond in kind. And so it went on, the argument growing in complexity and beauty and learning. But the winner was the person who reduced everybody to silence. And in that silence, the Brahman was present. The Brahman was not felt in the wordy definitions, but in the stunning realization or the stunning experience of the impotence of speech. Our minds go naturally into transcendence, like music, for example, which is the most rational of the arts in a way. And yet it is not about anything. You can't say what a late Beethoven quartet is about. And you know what it's like in the symphony when the last note dies away and there's often a beat of silence before the applause begins, a sort of very pregnant silence in the concert hall. You can see theology, a word which means discourse about God. The purpose of theology is to help people to live in that silence, in that beat of silence, and realize that when we speak about God, we're at the end of what words and thoughts can do.
And then there's the famous story of when Moses asked Yahweh what his name was. Yahweh replies, "I am what I am," essentially telling Moses, "Don't try to name me, don't try to define me."
Yes, but the word I am, Eyeh Asher Eyeh in Hebrew, it's an idiom for deliberate vagueness in Hebrew. If you say they went where they went, what you mean is, I don't know where they went. And when Moses asked God his name, God replied, in effect, "Never you mind who I am. That's not your business." And so there must be no attempt to name God. In the ancient world, when people called upon their gods, they felt they could manipulate them. Yahweh was not someone who was going to be manipulated. Again, you have the story of Jacob, who wrestles with an angel all night mysteriously, who turns out to be God. And he says at the end, "Tell me your name." And the being, who whatever it is, refuses to name itself, to give its name, but it blesses Jacob. You can be blessed by God, but not name him in the sense that you can sum God up. The word define actually means, if you look back at its origins, means to set limits upon something. And of course, God has no limits.
Well, let me throw in another word that seems to generate a lot of confusion, and that's transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that most people would say that kind of the essence of religion is some sort of search for transcendence.
Yes.
But if that's true, don't we need some understanding of what that transcendent reality actually is?
Yeah, and we get that understanding largely by doing it, by performing the taking part in the rituals of the church, and by adopting a self-emptying lifestyle that gets beyond egotism and greed, and which especially does that by means of a compassionate lifestyle.
So that's transcendent reality for you, then, is essentially sort of removing...
It's not just for me, Stephen. It's not just for me. I mean, this is not just a little bee in my own bonnet. I've been studying now the world religions now for about 25 years. And I'm constantly pushed up by all the world traditions to this notion of compassion as the litmus test, if you like, of true spirituality.
But I understand all of that about, you know, the importance, the essential religious message of compassion, of helping others in need. I'm still a little unclear why that necessarily involves transcendence, involves...
I was just about to tell
you.
Basically, all the world traditions have developed their own version of what's been known as the golden rule. Don't do to others what you would not like them to do to you. This requires constant transcendence of yourself. It requires us constantly to dethrone ourselves from the center of our world, to look into our own hearts, discover what gives us pain, and then refuse under any circumstance whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. If you do this all day and every day, you are in a state of continual ecstasy, as the Greeks said, a word that doesn't just mean an exotic trance, but which means a stepping outside of the self. Now, we have started to concentrate far too much on what we're transcending to, what we're going to, instead of saying what we are transcending from, what we are getting beyond. What holds us back from our best selves and from the reality that's being called God or Nirvana, Brahman or Tao is egotism. It's greed, which imprisons us, if you like, which holds us back by enclosing us in a little selfish bubble. Now, if we step outside that, if we are able to step outside it, I think we do enter a new state of consciousness.
Karen Armstrong, talking with Steve Paulson about her book, The Case for God.